This is the Unspeakable Podcast, and you're listening to Lovecraft Meets Tradecraft, the Delta Green Scenario Writing Workshop, recorded at Gen Con 2014. Enjoy.
Even after they've been abandoned for years by the casino company. Right, by the grace of geography.
There's almost no chance
of getting... Was Robitussin involved in any...
No, this is we had access to actual alcohol.
Pre-Nyquilada.
No, it was post-Nyquilada. This was the rich years. And so we're there going through this thing where the water has gotten into everything, so the carpet is puffed up like a shoggoth, and there's stuff coming down the walls, and occasionally you'll see a roulette table that was too fully stapled into the floor to be removed by hobos. And we were stumbling around, and every now and again, we'll wish we brought
up... Was it listing? Tell me it was listing.
It couldn't list. It was literally in an inch and a half of
water.
But at any moment, you had no idea what could happen.
Right, right.
Because
it could fall through the deck.
Into mud.
And as we're down there, and about, 2 minutes or 5 minutes after Tynes has said, you know what we should have brought is a flashlight. I'm going through the thing, and Tynes is, of course, a little ways ahead of me, because an unexplored place might have a death hole. And so he's in there, and I hear from Tynes in his beautiful Memphis lilt, this would be a great place to hide a body. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the most stable of the members of the original.
Yeah, that is pretty mellow.
Pagan House.
He is not.
Conclave.
He's also not a very coordinated individual. So you add the dark, 6'4", weird. I'm surprised he didn't. Break a leg or...
or my leg.
And then send Ken for help.
Yes,
Ken,
exactly.
Ken, go get the police.
Go, boy. Yeah. Go, boy. What's that? John Tynes, Trouble Down the Well? At the abandoned riverboat casino?
I think though, that's going to be... The next thing is, like, the bartender says, why are you telling me you fell down a well? Why do I care about this?
No reason.
He says, did I ask you to care?
Yeah.
You asked me what I did tonight.
That's the story.
Yeah.
That's
a free Delta Green adventure location.
Yeah, feel free to LARP that.
So the secret to
we're setting up a Patreon account with stories about John Tynes.
The secret to writing great Delta Green adventures is spend any given 12 hours with John Tynes.
Well, that's just really true.
Wow, that just segs right into that King and Yellow ticket we got in the mail.
Yeah, isn't that awesome?
I don't know. You weren't there. It wasn't that awesome. It was like
got the same fucking ticket.
Did you now?
That's what I meant. Wasn't that awesome?
No, it wasn't awesome.
Yeah, it was.
What did you guys get?
We got the King and Yellow stuff.
Yeah. Did you get it?
Yeah.
Oh God.
All the cool kids got it.
Yeah.
That says a lot.
Some guy sent a Tom Ring who put on the King and Yellow as a play in this dilapidated, rundown theater in in Olympia.
Well, this is a different thing?
Yeah, I guess so.
You're not talking about the stuff you're getting right now from Canada?
No.
Oh, are you not on the cool list? All right, then, never mind.
It's okay. Cool is not that cool.
Clearly, if you didn't get it, how cool could it be?
Shots fired.
That's right. Shots now hurt other players. I've been getting all the food lately.
It's already going?
God damn it.
This has been every episode of RPPR ever.
Someone says that. It's the ceremonial, oh shit, is it already going?
And they're off.
Well, we have our James Seppel theme music. Every podcast has its own character.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Wow. So thank you guys for coming out, everybody. We're doing our seminar, Lovecraft Meets Tradecraft and Creating Delta Green Scenarios. And so I think what we can do is kind of go around and kind of talk about our best top tips for what makes a Delta Green scenario click for us, and then here's some, I don't know, you guys can pitch things you want suggestions on or whatever. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't have a firm outline. I have a little brief outline.
And, is all of that the outline or just the scribbles on the first page?
No, just the scribbles on the first page.
Okay, good.
And actually just the bottom of the first page.
Yeah. Maybe the part that's torn off?
That's the one.
Yeah, that's upstairs folded up somewhere.
We are professionals.
So, and now
because it's really
just
bad.
A recipe for a montage.
Now Greg has my outline.
Doing this at home in a room by yourself is sad.
Yeah.
So,
but it could actually be really fun.
Right.
Yeah.
Couldn't
it? If you want
to. So I'm gonna get the boring part out of the way first and give my the top six things that came to me as scenario
fair.
Ideas, and then. Then I'll let them take over because they're way better at designing these things than I am.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow.
We'll let the man who wrote the little book.
Yeah.
Here we go again. Okay. Fair enough.
So my first sort of bugbear, and this is something that inspired a whole line of game products over at Hellbrain, is as you're putting a thing together. I mean, most Delta Green adventures kind of start with an investigative thing, and then segue or explode into a confrontation of some kind, and then explode into covering up for the confrontation of some kind, and they usually kind of go in that kind of a beat until everybody's crying. But for the investigation side, you want to be very wary of how you present sources of information, you know, especially be wary of sort of binary information sources, which, as everybody knows, is sort of the old standby of half-thought out Call of Cthulhu scenario design, you know, make the spot hidden role or the archaeology role to learn the key fact that'll move you forward to the next part of the adventure. And of course, you know, Trail handles this by not having you roll the stupid dice at all. You either get what you need.
They're only stupid because they don't give you what you want.
yeah, you spend the point. I mean,
sometimes they give you what you need.
It's not him.
Yeah.
It's not him. I'm just stupid.
Yeah. Ken being abused by his dice. Sad. Such a sad image. It really is.
I did kind of have it coming.
Yeah.
But
he's a
but,
good man.
Yeah. I mean, the ways around that, if you don't go that route, is of course you know, use the result of the dice for something else. You know, that if you're going to take as a foregone conclusion that, you know, as soon as the players sort of go here, they're going to wind up over in this direction, then if there's going to be a spot hidden role or an archaeology role or whatever, then use that as an opportunity to either feed them something else that's more interesting or save them from trouble later, or something besides just a failed result, meaning a sort of metaphorical brick wall.
Yeah, the failed result of the roll produces no information.
Yeah, look,
as opposed to part of it or bad information.
Yeah,
or
yeah, exactly. So I mean, having, you know, if you're going to key something to that kind of a skill use that needs dice, then make sure that you know ahead of time that the result, one way or the other, is going to make for an interesting moment at the table. If one of the results is just nothing happens, and that doesn't itself come with something terrible or implications, then, you know, sort of tweak it a little bit.
Yeah. If I can expand on that.
Go for it.
One of the things I put in the Delta Green book we're working on, like probably three times now, is the notion that, you know, the way I view scenario design is that these characters are fated to have their, their encounter with the uncanny. That's happening one way or the other. What the roles are for is, are you going to be equipped to maybe survive it or not? If you nail every role, you're going into that final confrontation, maybe with the tools you need to survive and, you know, keep things under control. If you blow all your roles, You're still gonna find your.
You'll find the scenario.
Yes, and it's just going to be like, wow, you're just gonna have no idea what happens to you next.
And the key there is do you want it to be a random result? You know, do you want unpredictability in this moment of the scenario? You know, at this point of the investigation, and if you want there to be unpredictability in there, and the chance that even the player character, who's the awesomest expert at whatever, is gonna slip on the butter on the floor, then that's when you use the dice. If it's not a time when you really want there to be, you know, randomness, or you don't want to risk derailment by randomness making things more interesting, then don't bother.
If the old hobo has a really great rant about what he saw, it should not require a persuade roll to get him to start.
Yes, that's super clear, I think.
Well, it's super clear. But then again, it's super clear to us
yeah. who have run into that brick wall many times since we were like 15.
I look at it in a slightly different way. I basically I have two scenarios: Night Floors and Artifact Zero. Night Floors is you know surreal horror. Thank you, surreal horror. And Artifact Zero is like clinical, scientific. You're fucked horror. But the key for me in building the scenarios that I really try and stick to is there are multiple axes of entering any clue. Mm-hmm. It is never, if you hit the hobo over the head, you're never going to find out about the silent one and blah, blah, blah. There's another way in there. So Artifact Zero is just laden with interconnections. And it was constructed that way. It's like Michael Richards is related to this, and there is a videotape of him doing this. And so if you F it up here, there's two dozen other areas you can find a similar clue. And it gives you a slightly different flavor of the story. It's not just a rote repetition of, oh, Richards disappeared on camera.
Yeah, think of it as a web, not a train track.
Yeah. Well, that's how I do it.
Yeah.
All right, what's your next point?
Any other thoughts there? All right.
Your next point, sir.
So my next one, I think we kind of covered, which is sort of be wary of randomness, which we sort of hit on. You know, that isn't to say dispose of randomness altogether, because it can make things really, really funny. But
and that's what you're going for, right?
I mean, funny for the GM.
Because yeah. tragedy happens.
Which is,
you
know, honestly,
exactly.
Okay,
yeah, got
yeah,
it. All right.
Yeah. I mean, we've been doing a late night adventure for the last couple of nights that Dennis has been running, and the dice have on occasion made things hilarious.
Now, to be clear, the situation they're in, I'm not rolling dice to see if they slip on the guy was mopping the floor and you give me a dex times five roll.
Do.
No, it's like the thing is under the autopsy table and you've turned on the gas. Mm-hmm. And the guy with the AR-15 is randomly shooting in the room. That's not me. Yeah. just to be clear.
That's just
I don't know, man. The thing where my character accidentally set herself on fire, I'm like, that is a little capricious. Dex times five roll to not emoliate yourself while lighting.
After you stand on a pile of bodies and pour 5 gallons of gasoline in the middle of a forest in the dark.
You know, when you say it that way.
Now, exactly how do you expect the forest to stop?
Okay, let's vote.
Well, first of all, there's the fire. That helps. Yes,
I think it's clear that Greg first failed an imp roll and only then failed the dex roll.
Then later on, he brought 12 sticks of dynamite over to the roaring flame to go, does anybody want this? I didn't make your roll then, did I?
Nope, it just went off.
That was off. That would have been justice.
The forest wants this.
So, but by the same token, when you're doing these adventures, because there's a certain pace to them, you know, and as we're running adventures, you kind of inevitably want to have a sense of what the pacing is likely to be like. That also can kind of has the danger of making things feel a little formulaic. So you want to remember that the horror that comes up, it ought to feel like it can come from anywhere, you know, at any time, right? You don't want the players necessarily feel really safe up until they get to the point where they're obviously putting their fingers, you know, in the anthill.
Yeah, and then 99% of the time it should not be supernatural.
Yeah.
It's having the state police show up wondering why you're flashing your FBI badge around in Oklahoma when you're based out of Maryland. When they're, okay, we're getting the guns, we're going to go down to shoot the thing in the pit, and why is there a state trooper out front? And, oh, fuck, hide the guns. That's an equivalent form of fear on the part of the players, and it often leads to really fun.
I would like to, yeah, that moment where
starting to get more gasoline from the forest.
One of my favorite moments on that was where a cop's walking down the street and we're like, okay, be cool. Be cool. And Brian and the cop's walking by and we've got the car with the firearms in it, and the officer says, evening. And Brian Appleton says, we were just parked here temporarily because we were having an office. We were completely legitimate tenants of this building. We were in no way trespassing because we have nothing. Which is why we're here at 3 o'clock in the morning to have an office that we rent with a lease that is up here and is completely legal. And I just felt my balls fall off. I just, oh my God. I'm like looking like, did that really just happen? Because it wasn't a real cop. It's just our roommate, John. There was no reason to have that layer of panic, but he actually just fucking did it.
He didn't even have to say a word, and yet you fumbled the fastball.
Because we're sitting there, quick, cops going, light cigarettes, because we're standing outside the building, and of course you're smoking outside, you know. A light up, you know, and nothing's going to happen. He's going to see the couple of smokers walking by, and then boom! All the information you need to create reasonable suspicion. How about I see your IDs? Oh, certainly, officer.
I suppose you've I hope you've taken away from this that scenario design is impossible.
It's a paradox.
Because random throwaway bits of business can kill everyone in the game.
That's true. Yeah. That is totally true.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, make sure that it stays random. I mean, if you're playing games with the same people over time, especially so they don't learn your tells, you know.
You know, your habit of having a cop walk by.
Okay, this time we're going to shut up.
Really? Good idea.
We're on cop number three. By
Elder time. Thing walks by, says, evening.
That really wasn't the problem. The problem was Blair is like, we'll just kill him and put him in the trunk. Oh my God, no.
Yeah, the trunk's already full.
Full of guns! First of all, there's a dumpster. Yes. What we want to do is put the dead cop in the dumpster next to the building where we're renting an office. Look, a traffic cam. Can we just cover ourselves in blood and just wear his skin? We could just wear his skin. That would be good.
Just report to the jail.
A Delta Green adventure is like a good lasagna. A layer of guns, a layer of dead cops, another layer of guns.
Yeah. So,
sprinkle some mythos on the top if you're into that.
I guess. Haven't even left the fucking block. Yeah. You're outside your office on a smoke break. You've already had a TPK and an all points bulletin on all your known associates.
Now, to be fair, he was playing with Brian Appleton and Blair Reynolds. That's kind of like, you know, going diving in the Olympics with like welder's goggles on, wearing weights around your ankles, you know, like.
But fortunately, no one here will ever play Delta Green with a dangerously unhinged psychopath.
Let me have my dreams.
These are all good people from the new generation of gaming.
They're learn from our mistakes. One of the big things that I really try and do is build outward from the Cthulhu Mythos element, if there is a Cthulhu Mythos element, or super science or something like that. I build outward from that, try and make up a bunch of believable motivations for all the characters who are kind of involved, and then let the players find their kind of vector of entry. Both Night Floors and Artifact Zero do that, and then you die. But there's a lot of interesting portions of the web before your death and being eaten by the scenario.
Web is beautiful before you meet the spider.
Yeah. Yeah. And people have survived, I swear.
I think my construction method is kind of the opposite, although it may be just a matter of going out and back.
Yeah.
But I first ask, what is the fear that I'm trying to explore, or the sort of contemporary issue that I'm trying to make horrible by literally travesty and satire? Mm-hmm. you know, with Numbers of the Beast, it was the surveillance, the proto-surveillance state. I wrote this in 1999. What a hilariously childlike view I had of, of the surveillance state.
The NSA is watching you type surveillance scary? Yeah.
Yes, right.
Can you imagine if we were all surveilled?
Yes, can you imagine if there was, you know...
A Google map of your movements based on your phone. That would be terrible.
What if some corporation tracked everything you bought? Yeah. That would be crazy talk.
Yeah. We're just going to think of the worst we can think of for the future.
No, seriously, in Maryland, like in the
that's
NSA,
why Ray
in 99,
yeah,
like,
right.
Come here, look at what this guy's writing. This is awesome.
This is awesome. Take notes. Should we pick him up? No. He's writing the manual. And so that was the fear, right? It's that fear, it's that proto-fear that mediocre Michael Douglas movie had, that it's everyone else is in the game except you. You're the target of universal surveillance. And I wrote the story about that, and then I had to come up with the mythos element. And really, there wasn't a mythos element.
Right.
It could be played without the mythos element. The mythos element that I eventually chose was the corn goddess, Shub-Niggurath avatar. Because of that, Children of the Corn, whole town is a ritual existence, Wicker Man type sensibility that I wanted to get. It's a modern Wicker Man, basically. Mm-hmm. The whole town is a construct. The whole town is a ritual. The whole town is engaged in something you're not. And so Shub-Niggurath became the natural monster to have there. And so it wasn't, I want to do a Shub-Niggurath corn goddess story. I want to do a surveillance story. I want to do a total paranoia story. I want to do a immersion in something that isn't you story. Shub-Niggurath seemed like the natural direction to go.
Right.
And then you go back out and you lay lots of fertility symbols and everything else into the thing so that it matches the monster that I put in.
Mm-hmm. Whereas I'm so much less structured than either of these guys. I use so much less thought and just like, oh,
it shows.
Yeah. You know, it would be neat.
But he tries.
I wasn't going to say anything.
Well, just listening to this, I'm starting to, you know what would be neat is a scenario where the people, where the characters show up and know no one and are trying to stay, stay kind of under the radar, and everyone knows them intimately and is, super helpful. And it's like, hey, Ken, you don't know me. You come up to me, and I'm like, hey, Ken, how's Sheila doing? How's that book she's working on? Scott, hey, did Jane get another story placed?
Yeah.
And
that would be incredibly uncomfortable.
And it's every person that you meet knows everything about you instantly. And it's like,
I have this terrible feeling that the car I drive out of town is just going to drive back in the other side of the town as I attempt to leave. It's just going to turn into that.
Who's kidding? So, hour two, Glancy would have like a pile of bodies in a room like this going like, I killed them all.
Now nobody knows me. I'm safe.
And so I will
and
start
then the,
with just
then the
that
old lady
image.
Comes down. How'd that decent murder spree go there?
Fun.
Need me help burying the bodies? My late Albert used to work guard at the old quarry. He knows where the back entrance is. They're not going to find those for a good day.
No, it would just be, I know why you did it.
Well then, ma'am, this won't come as any real surprise.
Here you go, lovey.
I'm coming to see you, Albert. This guy's plan's going to bring me.
That's awful.
So I will start with something.
This not thinking thing is pretty cool. Now that he mentions it, it's really well.
It turns out if the inside of your head is Greg Stolze's head, it's a lot easier.
I just scrape off a layer and I'm like, okay, I know where I want to go. How do I get there from here? And where do I go from there? What do I turn... Everybody knows and is your friend, but you have to betray them because you don't really know them. How do I get to that, and where do I go from that? And, I'll sleep on it.
So come back tomorrow, and Greg will finish the family.
The scenario will be kickstarted in probably 8 months.
It's about mushrooms.
Yeah. The thing I liked about what Ken and Greg said is the idea, the core conceit. Night Floors was not fair. It was just, I want to make a really good King in Yellow in the modern day thing that demonstrates why I think the King in Yellow is so
awesome.
Fucking scary.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And Artifact Zero was, what if you dug yourself up?
That was it. And then I was like, everybody's got to do this. It's going to be great.
So you got to the how.
Yeah.
About
yeah.
how you're in the dirt.
So it was similar, and the mythos, you know, didn't really enter into it in either of those until later. And I already had Project Rainbow, so I was kind of like, oh, well, of course, it's all that. And now I got to go write a whole bunch in Project Rainbow to make this work.
Darn it to hell.
Damn it. But yeah, I don't think it's all that different. I think like having the initial
your little Project Rainbow book.
Yeah, my tiny little Project Rainbow. Having the initial fear that you kind of want to elicit is a good way of describing it.
It's funny because I sometimes find myself digging through Lovecraft related materials and just trying to pull out. Well, let's see which critter hasn't been used recently, you know? Which critter's been ignored? And I'll actually start with the critter. Well, nobody uses Nodens because Nodens is stupid. Or my favorite.
You're stupid. Big, dumb Nodens.
Nodens doesn't care what you think.
But, like, my favorite being Sathagwa. Yeah. Sathagwa, everyone looks at the furry bunny in the room.
He's a Muppet.
And then forgets about using it. They just walk away from it. And oftentimes, I'll actually move from the, as far as the mythos aspect, I'll try and just dig something up that just hasn't get any love and say, all right, what are the aspects of this critter?
Yeah,
and what does it do? What is its purpose? What kind of things does it reflect? And, what's in its wheelhouse? And then trying to find something to build around that, you know.
Stick that into Google, see what comes up in the news.
Let's see what Sathagwa's doing.
No, I just mean, like, Sathagwa, looks like a rabbit. Yeah. Oh, let's see what's happening with rabbits in the news. Oh, my God, they're all dying in somewhere in Stinking Creek, Alabama. They found 10,000...
Stinking Creek,
that's right down the street from Dothan.
The road back and forth from Mobile to Birmingham, every time we go down there, we drove my son to move down there to a school now, and you go about halfway, you cross Murder Creek.
Awesome.
If you haven't found a way to get some Delta Green agents to throw a body in there, and then later
no
find
one
out,
will ever look at Murder Creek.
Todd,
who
is this guy in Murder Creek? What the fuck do we do?
We're putting out an APB for 5 men in their middle ages with no sense of irony.
So sometimes I'll end up approaching it from that point, but the
presumed illiterate.
The one thing that I would I haven't heard yet, maybe it's something that these guys do, is that most of these mythos stories or most of these mythos scenarios we're creating have a layer of human intervention between the supernatural and the effects that the supernatural has. Somebody is futzing around with spells, somebody's playing with an artifact, somebody wants a favor of a god, and usually that's the point of contact between players rather than a strict supernatural thing. Even Artifact Zero, which in a lot of ways feels as capricious and powerful as you can get as far as a mythos situation, is actually being initiated by humans. It's just that they're 50 years in the future.
Yeah.
You know?
they're sneaky that way.
Yeah. And one of the things when I'm doing that, I always want to try and figure out is where exactly do the antagonists, where does their reach exceed their grasp? At one point, they stop being as smart as they think they are, because if the bad guys aren't making any mistakes, there's no place for your players to start. If they do everything perfectly, there's no entry.
At some point, they have to stop being as smart as they think they are and start being as dumb as the players are.
Yeah. There's gotta be a screw.
Well, it doesn't even have to be dumb. I think that is good for that sort of whole humans can never touch the mythos, and even the most brilliant human is nothing but a simple orangutan compared to the, you know, Migo and the short space bus. But you can also have other things.
Special Migo?
The special Migo.
Trimbles.
That's right. They call it going full human. It's not.
Sadly, some of those lights just won't light up.
Won't light up. It's a light, won't light on one side. Taking him back to my workshop, my dear.
You can only do purple.
Fix him up there, and I'll bring him back here. But the...
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
But the thing, one of the things that I enjoy about the mythos, I enjoy, one of the things that is deeply weird and terrifying, if you do it right, about the mythos, is that they're... their priorities are no longer recognizable as human priorities. So you may say, aha, the Sethagwa cult that is murdering all the bunnies in Stinkin' Creek, Alabama, that their magic is causing all these bunnies to die, and they're growing nascent bat wings in their agonies, and their shoulder blades are popping out of their flesh to represent Sethagwa. It's like a sort of a spur or a phenomenological effect, right, of the spell. And you would say, well, that's a mistake. You've left this giant trail of dead rabbits leading right to your cult compound of Hyperborean Christianity. But what they don't see that as a mistake. What they see that as a manifestation. That's a good thing. The fact that we are making manifest what was hidden is signs of our devotion to the God, or signs of our sacredness, signs that... You know, it's a prophecy. It's something that was written about in the Testament of Cartimagos, that there will come a time when even Lepus will take wing. You know, that kind of thing. And it's like, look, we've done it. We've brought about the prophecy.
Dennis fixed Lepus, so we don't have to worry about him too. Did he take wing, Dennis?
A what?
Did he kind of take wing, actually?
Yeah, kind of.
Well, anyhow, and so their priorities are different, such that this has to happen, or... it's irrelevant that it's happening, because it may be a flaw, but it's the flaw of something they did 3 months ago, and it's not a flaw of their current plan.
Yeah, they don't even notice it.
They've moved on. Or it's not a flaw because, you know, they did it, and then the local authorities, who are corrupt by dint of having sat on top of a Sethagwa fane for so long, not actually corrupt, just they've been drawn into the magnetism of greed and selfishness that is Sethagwa, are... Not they're, I mean, they're selling the bodies on to a chicken packing plant, and it's like, great, everyone's happy. Yeah. They got little wings, we got chicken, everyone's a winner. And so that becomes not a flaw in their plan, but it's another doorway in, because you're like, wow, that's odd. Yeah. There's a lot of rabbit in this chicken.
And certainly, there's no reason why when you're designing the setup that your bad guys can't have the same kind of bad luck that players do. It's just that if you overuse it, the secret transport truck full of, you know, Mego stuff, you know,
they ran out of gas,
wrecked on I-5, or rear-ended. You do that, more than once, your players are going to call bullshit on you. You've got to have different ways of...
That's my favorite, when the players call bullshit on something. I'm just like, you're alive. Like, why... You should be happy.
You should be happy you're alive in a mythos universe. I always thought the point was that the living envied the dead.
Yeah.
Honey. Just steal yourself and stick it in.
I'm stealing. I'm stealing myself.
Is that what they call it?
The kids.
Do we have another? Oh, Dennis is gone.
No. I was just going to say the motivations of the antagonists are often really fun to explore. So, coming up with a kind of a point of view is more of the description I approach with the players. Like Cooter McGee, the guy in Owl's Head Mountain.
There's no plan.
He's 80 years young. The Mego have basically souped him up. So. Everything he tries to do to kill himself, he can't do it. He tries to hang himself, his neck reorients. He doesn't breathe anymore. He can't eat. He just wants it all to end. So his motivations are utterly alien to the player characters, and he's been living outside of humanity so long that when you hunt him, all your guesses are wrong. You're kind of thinking, oh, he's stalking us. No, he's wondering if you can end his life.
We did.
And he's trying to go, well,
it's the one thing we got right.
You did. You took an agent with you, but yeah, you did it.
That was his role, not mine.
But I guess my point is coming up with an interesting point of view for the antagonist to have, and it doesn't even need to make real sense. Mostly because these guys are tinkering with the mythos and are completely apeshit.
One thing I don't know that we've really managed to succeed at yet is an entry into the story that doesn't have those layers of human contact between... in some ways, I feel like, again, Artifact Zero almost feels to me like you're having direct contact with a great old one. You know, this effect that you can't comprehend. It's beyond your ability to fix. You know, it's from outside your time. You know, it really has a nice feel like that. And I don't know that we've actually managed to do anything with actual mythos critter where there isn't a layer of human interaction.
That's interesting.
You know, and it's tough.
Can you think of one?
One day I came home and there was an insect kusha guy in my wardrobe.
To an extent, I did that in the most recent in the mythos expeditions that we did for Trail. I did a scenario called Incident at the Border, which is about a meteor that hits in the Gran Chaco in Paraguay during the Gran Chaco War. And our heroes are, you know, geologists and astronomers, and they want to go get the meteorite and test it and do all the testy things.
Poke it,
as you do.
I'm going to poke it with a stick.
And the whole point of it, using the Gran Chaco War as the ne plus ultra of pointless wars, is that the struggles of the mythos entities are also pointless struggles.
Right.
And this is just a bullet fired by Larog, the Neo-Authotep avatar on Uranus, in his millennia-long war against Shub-Niggurath.
He's like, take that.
And the reason the Gran Chaco is such a desolate hellhole is because that's where the shells keep landing.
Right.
Is it hitting that until eventually the Earth will be empty there,
right,
and then he can move in.
This is
the pre-landing bombardment.
Yeah,
right?
It's just going to take 7.5 million years.
But he's a mythos entity. He doesn't
he's fine
shit.
With that. That's
and so
linear time is for the meat people.
And so the effects of the meteor they've created this whole magical and social and biological ecosystem around them. But there is no interface with the meteor. There's no friendly people you talk to. There's no meteor cultists.
There's no writing on the outside of the meteor.
No writing on the outside of the meteor.
Right.
All there is what has happened because of the meteor. I put a Mennonite outpost there, but they moved there really recently.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing they have is like an old crone who's like, this is like the story of Etzel versus the net god or whatever, you know,
right.
from the old country.
Right.
And, you know, and that's only because all human myth has basically been deformed by this cosmic war.
Right.
It's yet another ripple effect.
Right. Right.
So there's no, you know, there's no cult or anything. And when you get to the meteor, it turns out you're at the center of a fucking interstellar war zone, you moron. Good luck.
Yeah. You should be anywhere else.
Yeah.
And sand dwellers are the scab that Earth made up so that things could get to the meteor.
Right.
And so
that sounds fun.
That's what's happening.
It does.
And then there's no intermediation because, again, with the expedition style scenario, you get to the center of the horror and are undone by it.
Right. In Mortal Coils, now that I think of it, I did a scenario called Mysteria Matris Oblite, the Church of the Forgotten Mother. And it was kind of like that. It was, you know, like this horrible Ubo Sothla spawn had long ago hollowed out all the people in this little Mexican town. And they were kind of meat puppets with gelatin on the inside.
Stuffies. I like
stuffies,
the
stuffies, yeah.
I like the stuffies.
And they're just not. You go to the Mexican town, and there are no chickens. There are no, there's
dogs.
No food. There's no.
The children are not playing soccer.
Yeah, it played pretty well for a quick scenario.
I remember that because you had, the town had electricity, but no one could hear a power plant going, no generator going.
Yeah.
And so if they find out that the spawn is actually just running the generator itself.
Yeah.
It's just like a little mythos hamster. You know?
But yeah, now that I think of it, it's got a similar feel to it, and that's really cool. I kind of like wandering, you know, getting a different feel of wandering into a direct facing kind of mythos threat. It'll certainly shake things up, but being careful to kind of give the players leverage in one way or another. But it sounds like in yours, it's get the hell out of here.
Yeah, the leverage is recognize that this was a terrible idea.
Yeah. Very, very similar theme.
Ken, do you think we should run?
Ken?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of saving grace is that because the Dark Young of Shub-Niggurath and the Sand Dwellers are both sort of going after this meteorite, if you can stay alive long enough for the other one to get here, they'll fight each other and you can run.
Right.
But they're also going to kill your oxen, they're going to destroy your ox cart, they're going to eat all your native porters and guides.
Right.
And so you then have a 6-day walk across the Gran Chaco with no water or food.
Oh, that sounds fun.
So roll well.
Yeah.
And don't take any big parts of the meteorite, because then that will attract them.
Right.
Well, but of that's course, really on you.
But of course. I mean, come on. It's like, oh, scientist, what are you going to do to the meteorite? Leave it where it is and walk in the opposite direction as fast as possible.
Yes. No, but yeah. Tenure.
Tenure.
So attempted.
So it attracts a few monsters back to the university, you know?
I'm sure they have a special box for that.
The other, it might, but they won't be able to fire me for it.
Yeah.
The other bit of fun I love having is NPCs interacting with the player characters and the elements of the mythos and the other kind of antagonists in the scenarios in a believable, kind of really often very scary and startling way when they're presented with things that are just absolutely crazy apeshit. Like Night Floors, we had the poor cable installation guy who showed up 15 minutes after the Night Floors had kind of switched on for the evening and spent what he considered about a month upstairs wandering around Carcosa, and the agents kind of dealing with, you know, poor Claude trying to get him out of the Night Floors, and he's just like, you know what, man, I saw my mother and she was here and she had tickets from when we were a kid to my play and we were in the play and there were the... And you're just like, okay, Claude, listen, we're going to get out of here. And it was really entertaining. We had a lot of fun.
Claude, you're really bringing us down.
Yeah. It's kind of a bummer right now, Claude. Shut the fuck up.
You know, we're cool with it, but Scott.
Claude, does this cloth smell like chloroform? Problem solved.
Yeah.
Moving on.
It just smelled like your hand clenching really strong.
Around your throat.
But
something else about the other antagonists and even the other NPCs and such is, and it's I hope it's an easy thing to do, is always remember that this stuff is in motion. Everybody's in motion.
Yeah.
In the world.
That's what I learned from Massive Narrative, the bad guys who got their own clock.
Yep.
Yeah.
Even if you know your players are just dicking around or saying, I'm not going to go to Cairo. That's stupid talk.
Fucking Penyu has like 4 clocks.
Yeah, right.
He's on top of it.
He's clock master.
Dragon Island is cooking. You better be there.
So the idea that, you know, if the players dawdle or you know, aren't doing anything, there is an agenda at work. Something's happening. There's an effect that's building. You know, the evil is spreading. And trying to make sure that is in the background to pressure them to get them to act. And not just to get them to act, but also to allow them to see into what's going on, because the effects will change. The number of people around will change. You'll see new parties come into the scenario or disappear from the scenario. Those kind of things, to make sure that they know that there's an ongoing agenda. And there's an ongoing, something's in motion. I don't know. You use the word plan or plot, considering some of
this
stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
That gives the players some urgency when they realize that the world's not just waiting for them.
Yeah, this isn't a keep on the borderlands where it's just a monster hotel that's always been there.
Monster condo.
Yeah, it's a monster condo. They're just waiting for you to go in and rob them, you know, and take their stuff.
Yeah.
Well, what is the Apocalypse World mechanic for that? Is the fronts have the little clocks with the countdowns? Oh, they got a name for it. The doomsday clock, I think it is, you know, and if I was cooler, I'd remember that. But that it's like, okay, you know, if the players don't do this, it goes to quarter after. And if they're, you know, dealing with something else, okay, well, now it's quarter, now it's half after, now it's quarter till, and now it's five till.
And so you're saving the world. Congratulations.
I always knew I was gonna. I always knew it. I always knew I was better than people.
And then the last thing is the interaction of all these elements leads to horrible repercussions which should never be glossed over. So you get into a high-speed chase, you wreck the car, the trooper smashes into a tree.
There's that child's ball bouncing away from where he
gets thrown from the vehicle, and you can save him by intubating him with your first aid, or you can just leave him there because the state police is closing on you. What do you do? The really cool moments come out of this kind of stuff.
Yeah, half of a good Delta Green game is often...
damage control.
Yeah, damage control.
They never get past murdering state troopers.
It's mostly janitors, to be fair.
Yeah. And then,
to date.
and more good attendance.
The quickest way to get to that is just to make sure that the players are in a place with human beings around, you know, that they need to protect by concealing this from them. And sometimes that means
hitting them in the head with a radio.
I want to point out on the damage control, one of the most horrifying scenarios that John Crow ever subjected us to was a non-Delta Green scenario where we're playing local law enforcement and a group of investigators came to town to fix our problem. All right? And they just caught a swath of murder and destruction through the community, and It was absolutely horrifying playing the locals, having had several games with these NPCs and these characters in this community, and sort of getting attached to them and knowing who they were, and they were helpful, and they, you know, managed to help us deal with some of the problems that had come up. And then out of the blue, suddenly these, you know, there's these horrible
beat
murders.
To death with right. his own radio? Right. What kind of monster does that? His son just got accepted to Duke.
Exactly. And that moment, actually, that scenario actually made me sort of think about the kind of destruction we left in our path.
Yeah.
And we're like, yeah, okay.
We're doing a terrible job of covering it up.
Yeah.
We need to time our arrival to other strangers who can be framed or blamed.
Why do you think you call the guys at Phenomenex them in there? Who are the new strangers now? Well, those are guys in the van with the satellite dish before Miss Maybe got set on fire. We should talk to them.
Well, we don't have enough information until there's another killing. Someone call Phenomenex.
That's exactly what they're there for. We ran six scenarios in a chain where you played Phenomenex, and it was a bloodbath, but it was also great fun. But John Crow is the master of the last kind of big thing, which is making sure the players never feel absolutely secure in their situation, or feel like they've completely outguessed you on all fronts. You know, he ran the Realm of Shadows.
Yeah.
And I'm the brilliant guy who's going to hide out in the cemetery and find the ghouls. Sorry if this is a spoiler. And so I'm going to go stand on the recently dug grave that I hear scritching in the bottom of and just stomp on it, because I figure it's ghouls, right? They're going to be a couple feet down. No, they're like 80 meters down in a vertical shaft that they've been digging for weeks. And I plummet with the coffin. And, you know, I'm wearing my guns, but they fall to the side and get sucked down in the dirt. And I'm in a coffin with ghouls underneath me trying to get me. And
I mean, I'm just a simple country game master there, Dennis. But if my players are stamping on the ghoul-infested grave, I don't have to work so hard to outsmart them.
This word you're using, outsmart.
Listen, Lake.
Well, I think we've really put one over on Old Crow. We figured out that there's ghouls in this cemetery. Time for my patented unstoppable stamping move.
You just can't get around Crow's brilliance.
That's right. A man's a genius, a mastermind.
I never thought I'd be tapped in to go to grave. Yet here I am.
Listen, right. Lincoln La Paz was many things. He was also very rich, which is how he got his degree.
Too?
Yeah, he was handsome.
Okay.
I'm telling
you about my character. But yeah, John Crow murdered him. Heartless.
John Crow right. murdered him.
Yes,
I think it was an assisted suicide attempt.
I survived that.
Who was it that said to the pack of French Guyana cultists, "Hey, I saw all the player characters run that way. You should chase after them. Oh, wait, I'm speaking English." Was that you? Okay, so Lincoln La Paz, once again, was outsmarting this John Crow guy, right?
I still survived that part.
Did you survive?
No, I died.
You were the chosen of Morrigan.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway.
I guess
what I'm saying is, whenever
Lincoln La Paz will make more food for our people, send him to the next sea.
That's totally what happened. And it never got those guns back.
Your name in ghoul means rainmaker.
So, Crow always has a way.
I call my one gun Foresight.
of making all the kind
you
of
ones backfire.
The monsters feel new. I mean, his ghouls are really interesting.
You know, everything he kind of brings.
That's a good point. Anytime you can take a retread of the material.
And just try and make it a little more interesting,
That was the last thing that I was going to suggest as a thing to discuss, is to disguise the horror. You know, I mean, Call of Cthulhu has, and you know, you can get the Monstrous Malorium, or whatever it's called, and have tons and hundreds of pages of monsters, you know, and read that.
And all your players have read it, too.
Yeah, and all your players have read it, too. So take a few minutes to figure out what to tweak. And you don't have to tweak much, you know, but what to tweak to make it just slightly unrecognizable, you know, so that it leaves the players...
The ghouls in New Orleans don't dig. You can't dig in New Orleans. You can't have underground tunnels in New Orleans. Your ghouls will drown unless they have scuba gear.
Yeah.
So it creates a completely new ghoul ecology because they cannot feed in the traditional way.
Or they don't breathe. That would be another possibility.
Yeah, right.
How are that's crazy talk. Where would that happen?
Where are they possibly going to find bodies in New Orleans?
Well, that's the wonderful thing about New Orleans. It is a corpse factory. So, no wonder they settled there.
Not to plug a perhaps not immediately Delta Green associated product, but doing change-ups on the Mythos monsters is sort of what I've been doing for the last year and a half for Pelgrane Press with the Hideous Creatures series. Mm-hmm. And again, I suppose your players...
Everybody here getting that? Subscribing to that? Downloading it? Anyone? Everybody else, you're missing out.
You're doing it wrong.
It's part of Ken Writes About Stuff, which is the thing that I do for Pelgrane. Every other one is a different Mythos monster, and the whole goal is to give you stuff to change about the monsters to screw with your players.
Yep.
Which is, you know, usually I can do, you know, describe it differently. Don't make the Shoggoth green and black, right? Give it a different color scheme. Give it a different flavor. Give it a different batch of descriptions.
Yeah.
That alone is going to make it seem
fresh. Was it somebody in Stealing Cthulhu that suggested about the Shoggoth that, you know what, maybe the Shoggoth is aerial?
Yeah, that's me.
They can change themselves. And
why would they?
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be a thing confined to the sinus of a tunnel underground, you know. It could be a completely different physical sort of entity.
That was merely the shape that was convenient for that tunnel.
For that tunnel, What else would you be if you were stuck in a tunnel?
And so the notion of returning... I mean, the whole reason Lovecraft made up all these damn monsters in the first place is because vampires and werewolves and ghosts and ghasts and everything else had been done to death, and everyone knew what a vampire was, and they knew what a werewolf was, and
they knew the rule book.
It wasn't the unknown anymore, and that's what Lovecraft is after, the fear of the unknown.
That's kind of where we are where we've been in Call of Cthulhu, basically since the first year after Call of Cthulhu came out, when everybody playing Call of Cthulhu had read all of Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just, it's not like it's a new challenge, but it's still one you have to remember to face and the next best thing to completely making up your own cosmic horror is to take one that's already there and just take 5 minutes to sort of monkey with it until it'll surprise the players.
Putting it through a cultural lens is really convenient. Finding some great relationships.
That's every Hideous Creature has mythic resonances or mythic realities.
Yeah, we did on the leave taking of the Silent One, and it's, you know, a Latin text from the it's a Gothic Necronomicon translated into Latin, translated into English, and suddenly you're like, what the hell is it? It comes down from the sky, you know, like. That's the best I got.
It's a star vampire.
But you can disguise these things. And, you know, I've seen a lot of game masters, I've been in a lot of games where they just drop the name of the monster.
Oh, yeah, they say it out loud.
Yeah, and it's...
Five Byakki fly down. You know,
what would that be exactly?
Yeah, I try and sneak behind the backstab.
But even more than that, I mean, go out of your way to change it. You know, if it's going to be a star vampire... Don't give it to them as a squiggly organ with lots of, you know, orifices and tubes and stuff when it fills up with blood.
And sometimes you can just go back to the original source, because the star vampire, the thing we remember is the giggling and the invisibility that slowly becomes red as blood. Well, when Block described the first one, he describes it as pachydermis. Right? That it has trunks and tusks.
Yeah.
And big sort of cutty claws.
Right. So the second you say all that, what the fuck is that?
Yeah, it's like you feel these claws and bony tusks protruding from midair, and it's like, what the hell?
Right.
I don't know what that is.
And that's another thing, is go back to the source material. If there's a creature in the manual that you want to use that you think is interesting, find that story that it came from. And read that, and I guarantee you that's going to spark some ideas.
Yeah, the Loigor, for example, I just did.
Loigor?
That, thank you.
Wow. Loigor. Let that drop, are you?
Loigor. According to Wilson's original story, they got like 12 powers. And you think the Loigor are over blessed already in Basic Cthulhu with the turn into a dragon, and they can have a vortex, and they can have a telekinesis, and they can do. This and that.
It's
like, that's nothing compared to what they can do. They've got all manner of other stuff that Wilson just mentions in the course of the story, because he's building a notion of the Loigor as a totality, right? A literally totalitarian vision that are responsible for everything. And so they can do everything to Wilson, but when you run into them, you're like, man, there's no... Even as the GM, you're scared of the damn monster, and you haven't even put in the campaign yet, because they can do anything. Wow. It's like, all right, how do you fight Superman? You know, you really feel for Kurt Swan or Schaffenberger or whoever the hell it was to write those things.
With something like the Loigor, you probably want to sort of focus on one or two of those aspects, and because our goal is a little different from Wilson's. I mean, we don't want any one supernatural thing to sort of be the explanation, right, for all the evils in the world or anything like that.
So basically, Azathoth. Everything else is just detail.
Azathoth's fault. He's just sitting there listening to music.
This is my jam.
The great old ones.
The Ken series. I'll reiterate. Go get it and read it.
Can I get? You guys got anything? I get. Can I get a show of hands for two questions? One. Anybody here read the Onyx Path Mummy book?
Yeah.
Okay, so this won't be new to you. Has everyone here seen John Carpenter's The Thing?
Yeah.
Okay, lots more hands there. As I was writing that, and
you wrote The Thing?
No, I wrote about The Thing.
Jesus, sorry.
That was John W. Campbell.
Oh.
I was analyzing.
Greg wrote
the movie.
John W. Campbell.
I was analyzing the movie The Thing as a as a perfect horror setup. And I'm like, okay, you've got three angles of attack here. And, your three threats are, number one is the thing from another world that can go into Hulk mode and take you to pieces. Problem number two is you're in Antarctica, and if you go outside unprotected for very long, you will be a frozen corpse. Problem number three is the suspicion and mistrust among your fellow humans, who are apparently scientists investigating the effects of alcohol on firearms. So, and the thing from another world will assimilate you if it gets you alone, and you will become it, and it will become you. And so this is, you've got all these problems, any one of which is pretty scary on its own, but in each case, the solution to one puts you at risk of another. Oh, the thing's after me. I'm going to run out into the cold. Oh, shit, now I'm cold. I'm going to go back into where the people are. Oh, shit, they're suspicious of me because I was alone out in the cold, and now they think I'm the thing. Okay, well, to prove I'm not the thing, I have to show them where the thing... Oh, crap, now the thing's going at us. And so it just... If you can set it up where you have the, each solution is its own problem, you will just basically have them pinballing back and forth between all these issues, and you won't have to have a huge, scene one is this, scene two is this, and it won't be all railroady. It will just be, okay, what are you guys going to do now? Go outside. Okay, you're outside, it's cold, but you're no longer
being...
You were
using that con point anyway, Maria.
You're no longer being monstralized, but you're cold. What do you do now?
And people
thank
say,
God,
I'm cruel.
Thank God the thing isn't there to make your health go down. Yeah. Everybody loses 2 hit points from frostbite.
And the other great element of the thing is that it plays into something that you'll see in a lot of the great Delta Green scenarios. Or I'm thinking of the Horror of War things. Not to plug his current Kickstarter or anything.
Thank you very much, sir.
But
well
it's...
done.
All is forgiven.
It's got a lot...
Don't show your neck again. That's really creeping me out.
Fine. Be like that.
So alluring.
Now I've forgotten what I was
saying. Mission accomplished!
Was that he's got a lot of great real-world stuff going on and has, done the research and found, here's this little fascinating thing about the tunnels in World War I, and wow, how dangerous they were, and wow, how deadly it was to dig under the enemy position and do an uplift attack where you pack tons and tons of dynamite, and where they go up and down. And so now we've got all this three-dimensional, like an aerial dogfight in super slow-mo because you're digging instead of flying. And that is the
Immelman turn will fucking kill you.
And that is Dig for Victory based on the realities of historical war. Or you can take something, one of the ones I've worked on for a book that's forthcoming is I did a lot of research on diseases and outbreaks. And so, okay, on one hand, you've got maybe a mythos threat at the same time. As a unintended consequence of that, oh yeah, everyone in town is getting sick and dying. And, okay, what are you going to do? Are you going to go after the source, or are you going to triage this 5-year-old? So that's,
That certainly would add, layers of conflict or at least tension into it. But I guess, when you start bringing up, you've done some research on outbreaks and or how diseases are passed, and where that sort of takes me is, you read about this stuff and you see sort of real world reactions to crises. How the authorities react to a problem. Just studying those sort of things are always inspirational to me for the next Delta Green scenario. I mean,
showing how the players can fuck things up.
At first, I was a little annoyed that Hurricane Katrina came along and messed up my ghoul scenario for New Orleans. And then after watching the horrifying reports coming in, I'm like, no, this is actually opening the city up. This is making the scenario perfect. Seeing that militarized police.
And there's the silver lining for a man. Far, far away.
Yes,
from
some of that comedy that's way over there and nowhere near me. Yeah.
Right.
I'll have a different story when Mount Rainier blows up.
As tragedy is when I cut my finger, comedy is when you walk into a manhole and die, scenario seeds are when 1,000 people drown thanks to negligence.
No. In all honesty, it is generations of negligence.
Yeah.
It's not like,
that's right.
You're like Bob didn't turn a wheel. Okay. It's everybody in the city of New Orleans presumed I'll be dead by the time this happens. And guess what? Many of them were. So,
that's a problem for future me to deal with.
That's right.
I don't envy that
he's
guy.
He's
going to
have it my time.
Tom Roulon.
Time to get some hurricanes, boys.
That's right.
Oh, wait, that's irony.
So I guess the last thing for me is... Also, take a few minutes to do the research and ground what you're doing in enough mundanity to make it feel legitimate, and to make it feel like the characters are in a world that has things at stake, and that can go a long way towards not only setting the stakes but also providing you with a sense of how everyone else is going to respond to the crazy thing that the player characters do, and give you tools to kind of describe what's happening and describe the ramifications and the repercussions. Delta Green is, we sort of laugh and laugh and laugh because we all love gallows humor and players are so crazy, but it's, it's not supposed to be... I don't know, Men in Black, right? Or the this sort of
or the laundry,
or even the laundry, right, or the sort of over-the-top thing, anything that's kind of over-the-top, it's supposed to feel like real people in the real world facing a situation that's totally beyond either of those. And so so the more you can kind of find and pick out those little details about the environment, those go a long way in my experience.
And both the mundane details and the uncanny details.
Yeah. So, I mean, so for instance, I did, for the new game, I put together a real quick playtest adventure that was really combat heavy in order to put the combat rules through their paces, set in Afghanistan. And I meant for that to be like a 4-page, just here's a fight, play it out. But the more I may be dissuading you here, because the more I started sort of digging up little details to put in, the more interesting it got, you know. And I started adding to it, and then it was like a 20-page little thing. But
I think he just likes the word "little." I don't think he knows what it means.
Lot.
Oh, that's right. He said the master of scenario economy.
Shane's like, yeah, we went out to the Mexican restaurant, had those little 32-ounce beers.
I'll psychoanalyze that later when I have a little time.
any year now, you'll have more time.
Yeah. So it was. Doing that process was super fun for me. I mean, I don't know where it is for you, but it was great for me because it was
there.
Not
here,
only was it digging
most of these scenarios are just great for us.
It was digging up stories, and things about what happened and what has happened in some of the worst moments of our war in Afghanistan over the last 10 years, and seeing how people have really responded to really awful crises, and what the environment was like. And doing that for the sake of grounding the player characters in it and giving them a sense of what they're grounding the players in it and giving them a sense of what their characters are experiencing, also provided tons of details that suggested ideas for the adventure and suggested sort of new directions and what shaped the NPCs should take and what shape the threat ought to take when it manifested.
Cool.
Yeah. So, okay, any questions, ideas, suggestions, requests, anything like that from you folks? Yes, sir.
Gentleman who we're not familiar with in any way.
remember to project, because the recorders are way over here by us.
I only played Delta Green before, I've never run it, but one thing I've noticed that kept popping up when you guys were talking about it is this idea that you never sort of explicitly addressed of hard decisions. Like, that's to me the feel of Delta Green when I played it, is that you're stuck with some really crappy moral quandaries.
Yeah.
Yep.
What to do. There's no good choice.
Right.
Yep.
So that seems to be an element.
Yeah, as the GM, you want to be proactive about making sure that's the case. Right?
Well, you've got your choice between three bags of shit here.
Right.
There's the 5-pound, there's the 10-pound, and there's the 3-pound, but the 3-pound is leaky.
Yeah. If you accidentally, you know, say that provide one of those bags is sugar, you know, then it's
that
suddenly a lot
happen.
Less interesting. Right.
I think we've got that covered. It's never going to be a bag of sugar.
Right, right.
Well, I mean,
unless it's got a turn in it.
But again,
it's right in the middle.
Right. If it's sugar.
Oh, sugar thing. Oh, fall for it again.
I hate Delta Green. Yeah.
Damn you, Detweiler, another sugar-crusted turd for players.
You know, 4 more of these, I'm going to stop opening this bag.
No, I knew I had won as a game master when Glancy turned to me and said, I don't like Acel anymore. And I was like, I win. I made him turn on his own creation. Yes. Congratulations. I agree. Troubling moral choices are kind of the hallmark. And I also love the idea of it's always a kind of a desperate, on-the-ground decision-making process.
Well, that new or recent Walking Dead video game that's just a decision tree.
Yeah.
I mean, and I haven't played it, but the reports I'm hearing about from guys like Tynes is it's all about just making these decisions and living with the results.
Yep.
And there's no do-over on that. You're just stuck with these results.
Yep.
And it's not about combat. It's about choices. And, you know, and the repercussions.
At the save point, you have to roll to a shotgun and blow your own head off.
Yes. Hit the recorder or roll to the shotgun and start the game over.
One thing that I find really useful for that, and this is something my players in my games, and it's not Delta Green necessarily, but about every third game, the players will look up from some god-awful thing that they've involved themselves in for what seemed like the best possible set of reasons. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, I think we're the villains in this game. Those guys over there, the guys who work for the Crown of England and are trying desperately to keep the King in Yellow from burst, those were probably the good guys. I think they're the player characters.
Yeah.
I think they're NPCs in the good campaign.
Did you just say the good guys? Yeah, I'm pretty sure I did.
And you can bring that into relief if you're not
talking about Rosencrantz.
If you're waiting too long for your players to come to those moral revelations, you can bring that into relief with NPCs who are disposed to be helpful until they hear what you've done.
Right.
And then they criticize you for murdering a pyramid of bodies or whatever. And you
couldn't think of any solution to this problem other than pistol whipping him unconscious and leaving him on the floor of the burning hospital.
Yes.
In my defense, and the hospital is where he can get the best treatment.
In the next 15 minutes.
And the best outcome of that is when the players know that they made the choice that seemed moral the whole way through, but realize it's still indefensible. That they have simply moved beyond the pale for whatever reason. And it's, you know, it's again, it's like you want to imagine, it's like having been a commander of some unit in Afghanistan reading, you know, daily costs. And he's like, well, I agree, this is a shitstorm.
Right.
But I did not have my choice between shitstorm and no shitstorm.
Right. It's quality of shitstorm.
There was no box for no shitstorm.
I chose shitstorm over shitstorm with heavy P.
Yeah, right. And so, and you just don't understand it.
Yeah.
And that is a way to bring that in. You can have NPCs who do that, or you can have an institutional review process, or you can have any number of methods by which you can have the moral light come on in the middle of the scenario.
Somebody is trying to sell me on pushing through to Mr. Ivy here a scenario that essentially involves the terrible acts of Delta Green players coming back to haunt them in a sort of an interagency investigation review, where the people who are investigating them are really good moral people. You know, they are actually the good guys who've done nothing wrong. You've done everything wrong. You know, and you know the idea that you're being pursued by these guys and they want to investigate you, and they want to know what you're up to, and they want to know where that car went and what happened to your service revolver. What do you mean it was stolen out of your home? You know, that sort of thing. And then the player's thinking, well, I know how we can fix this.
Mm-hmm.
We can kidnap his children. And then, where that hole just keeps getting deeper and deeper, you know.
Or, plan B, when you're choking to death, don't take another bite.
Well, the other option I would suggest is also robbing them of some of the joy of their victory. In Holy War for Eyes Only, I had some players actually manage to capture the Cirin of Glocky sorcerer. And during the course of that, they ran him out of magic points. He goes inert. He looks like a dead body, right? And so the cops are all standing going, hey, he sure is a dead body. It's a good thing you caught him and killed him and all, and now he's dead. And they all know, no, he's not dead. He's out of magic points. They'll regenerate or whatever. He'll be a problem later. So step one was, you know, break into the morgue and murder him again.
This sounds really familiar.
Yeah. They well,
it's
my favorite
what the Germans
part of
call
was,
a leitmotif.
They get into the morgue, you know, and they hear knock, knock, knock from inside one of the doors. Help, I've been trapped in this drawer. Could somebody let me out? There's been a terrible mistake. And, well, the dipshit player goes, we know who you are. You know, not going to do any good. We know who you are, you know. And he says, oh, really? Spell, shoot your partner in the head. And as Chris pulls out his gun and, goddamn it, rolled a double lot right there on the table. There he is. I took 75 points in pistol. We're 2 feet away. I can't miss. He pulls out the gun. Click. And the other players tackle him. And they eventually realize we're going to have to go back in here and kill this guy. And they look around the we're not just going to have to kill him. He's a horrible zombie. We're going to have to dismember him. So there they are, suiting up in the plastic smocks while he's locked in the drawer. And I just want to saw.
Can we do this
here
while I'm young?
I just want to insert in here that, you know, a Delta Green scenario has gone the right direction when the word smock has appeared.
They get done holding him down, handcuffing him, sawing him apart while he's wriggling with, you know, they're winning. I mean, yeah. They're clearly winning. And then what are we going to do with this body that, you know, we've clearly murdered around twice? We probably don't want to ask questions about why it was dismembered. Okay, we'll get rid of it. That's even less questions, I guess. But by the time they're done...
Yeah, we'll burn it up in a fire. Yeah. Nothing ever went wrong with burning it up in a fire.
They got acid. They went to Walter White and they dissolved it in acid. And when they're sitting there with their big barrel of sorcerer gumbo, I just remember, you know, I just remember... Chris going, you know, I don't feel really good about any of this anymore. I realize we stopped a murderous undead sorcerer, but, you know...
Something about
the victory. We're never going to get this smell out of our clothes.
The question, we are the good guys, right? Needs to come up a lot.
Yeah.
It's the smell of victory.
Yeah.
The smell victory of victory is sorcerer gumbo, yeah.
Delta Green, as it's always been presented, and this is one reason that it's kind of got legs, is that it is... that it isolates the player characters from the kind of power and resources and authority that you think they ought to have as people who are closely related to the federal government, you know, as agents of the federal government. So they have sort of tangentially that they could have access to all that, but they need to avoid having access.
All you have to
dangerous
do is bad jacket the cult of Glacky as the Sword of Jihad, and you're in business.
Yeah, but, as long as you don't mind a bunch of normal, non-Delta Green mundanes picking a fight with them.
Yeah.
So, but that isolation has been key, you know, to making sure that the player characters don't have easy solutions, right? To making sure that the only solutions at hand are whatever we can do with, you know, the with what's in our pockets and in the car and in that grotty
green
know, public,
box
public lo- yeah rented locker down the street that we didn't stock and so and that's a thing that we're going to want to make sure is present going forward, you know, where when there's a Delta Green campaign where you're in the group that's been reactivated for good or for ill in the course of the Great War on Terror, you may have different challenges, right? You may have easier access to a lot of those resources, but for the GM, the challenge is still going to be to keep the players isolated and to keep the players aware of the ramifications and the repercussions that are gonna fall down around their ears the second they do something. They take a misstep.
Does anyone else want to put another quarter in the panel? You do. He does.
Just one thing tangential. Some of the new slang you've developed, like bad jack thing, that really seems like the sort of thing that you know, government professionals or intelligence professionals would use, you know, to describe something that's really kind of horrible.
Did you say that I invented it? It's actually slang.
It is awfully horrible. Yeah.
Well, yeah. No, I didn't.
It's real stuff.
That's real slang. That's really. That was an FBI term when they were doing their COINTELPRO thing against groups like the Black Panthers, and they wanted to, or even they did it against the mob. They'd say, "Hey, how'd you like to inform?" No, fuck you, Mr. Fed. Well, that's okay. We're just going to let your buddies know that you're informing.
Yeah.
And then they're going to kill you. So you better inform
them.
That's
okay. You don't have to tell us anything. We're just going to publicly be seen talking with you, smiling, shaking your hands.
And believe me, when the peace movement tries to kill you, it takes forever.
But it's about hanging. It's about hanging a bad rap on somebody, and it includes. It's also crept into use as a kind of term for frame.
Yeah,
as well,
the snitch jacket.
Snitch jacket. Yes.
Yeah. Mm. So, you were in there talking to the warden. I didn't say anything to the warden. Yeah, but you were not saying anything to the warden for like an hour and a half.
I noticed you have a new fluffy pillow on your bunk. So you didn't tell
you
him
leave Raul out of this.
Wow. That's not the fluffing I had when I was
young. Yeah, keep talking, Scott.
Do we have any other questions?
Something less oral sexual.
Yeah, in the back.
We've got a change.
Go down.
So there are there examples from, you know, non-Delta Green publications of scenarios or campaigns that you guys think are worth studying?
Oh, hell yes.
Master General Thotep. Master General Thotep. Master General Thotep. Master General Thotep. I adore that book.
And also, Master General Thotep is, of course, incredibly dated, and it's limited by its structure and its size. But
no, it's beautiful.
and yet it outshines all of
I hate it.
Yes, it does. It does, but, you know, you got to understand it's still a creature of its time.
Well, as are we all.
Yes.
The scenario that I would recommend studying for inspiration and then also for emulation is the scenario Raid on Innsmouth from the Innsmouth book Chaosium did. And I don't know how many of you guys know it, but it's the Raid on Innsmouth in which the player characters are parceled out into the Secret Service team, the FBI team, the Coast Guard, the Navy, and the Marines. And so each character is surrounded by a bunch of ablative NPCs who are played in the scene by the other players.
Right.
And so, therefore, the GM has an 80% kill rate in every scene.
Right, right.
And the players get to engage in that beautiful lust mord that is at the heart of all Call of Cthulhu.
Right.
And the single player character is terrified because GMs are not known for being able to really target their shots necessarily. And it also gives you a sense of, on the one hand, it really ups up the game, and it gives you a sense, especially in War on Terror type scenario, if you imagine your SEAL Team 13 or whoever is out there at point dropping in on the plateau of Lang or whatever, the kind of crap that is going to go down and the kind of crap you're dragging perfectly good Americans into by dint of being terrible at compartmentalizing, by dint of calling in the resources that you theoretically have. Yeah, you can call for reinforcements. That means you've guaranteed killed 10 American Marines. That's really the sort of thing the Taliban is supposed to be doing, not you, FBI guy.
We'll bring in reinforcements. What's SEAL Team 6 done for me? They did kill Bin Laden. I met lately.
Well, those guys are rotated out. It's a whole new SEAL team.
Yeah, that's right. The raid on
It's like the Baltimore Colts.
So, raid on Innsmouth and any other. Naruto, obviously, raid on Innsmouth is genius, and it's worth studying just as a work of ambitious structure.
It's also beautifully illustrated by John Schneider.
Oh yeah, that's gorgeous.
Yes.
Yeah, it is. And what else? Any others? Those are both pretty huge. Any sort of smaller scale?
Small scenarios. Convergence is a beautiful scenario. John Tyne's original Delta Green scenario.
That's technically Delta Green.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Non-Delta Green.
Non-Delta Green. In Media Res, then, for John Tyne.
Oh.
Yeah. Is a beautiful, odd thing that I've been killed in three times. Once in 15 seconds.
Yes.
In Mid-Air Res, he takes a lot of liberties. You know, you don't get a stat block.
Yeah.
And that's deliberate. You know, he wants to sort of plunge you into insanity immediately. And so it too is a very kind of creative and interesting adventure to put people through, and it's loathsome and awesome.
Do you have any advice for new keeper like myself who's getting into this, getting into the degree for managing minutia of government agencies, like finding out what jurisdiction?
I mean, learn as much as you can, but don't try to learn more than you can. If you have a player who knows more about this stuff than you, get them inside the tent pissing out rather than outside the tent pissing in.
Yeah.
That's
really good advice, actually.
I ran Blacksat once, and this is my NASA Delta Green prequel kind of crossover thing, and it turned out that one of the guys in a game of it right here at Gen Con last year was an astrophysicist. And I'm like, huh. he was a very cool astrophysicist who's he's like, yeah, you made, afterwards comes up and is like, you made a couple mistakes. And I'm like,
not anymore. I had you in my game. That fixed everything.
And so, yeah, I think I lost those notes. But yeah, I'm not proud.
Wow.
But that if you can get the, you know, the biologist in your group to, you know, help you and say, okay, you know, take them aside. Here's the kind of technobabble I need. Usually they'll be like, all right, this is my chance to shine by helping the game move forward. And, you know, that's actually even more fun for them than pausing to pedantically fix the game when they say, oh, well, no, that's not actually what Agar does.
Well, then what you do is if they say, well, that's not actually what Agar does, you say, all right, you're the CDC guy. Why would they be using Agar in this circumstance? What does this tell you about what's going on? And they're like, well, first of all, it tells me that maybe they didn't have any of the new pectin or whatever it is. Right. And maybe it tells me that there's this going on and this. And you're like, okay, any one of those might be the reason. And meanwhile, you're like, okay, it was reason three because that was the awesome one.
don't beat yourself up. And understand that it helps a lot if you play with people who are just as ignorant as you are.
Yeah, you only have to be smarter than your smartest player.
You can cover, like, 80% of the challenge with a very small amount of work. You know, I mean, just go to... since Delta Green often deals with the player characters are like U.S. law and federal law enforcement, if you just sort of learn the basic overview of what federal law enforcement is responsible for compared to state law enforcement and local law enforcement and what their functions are, right? I mean, their functions are to procure evidence, to prosecute, you know, and secure convictions or more likely, you know, confessions of crimes, right? That is a goal that often leads in really weird directions. So the more you research that, the more interesting it gets from a narrative standpoint. But you can cover a lot of the basics of just sort of making it just believable enough for your ignorant players by learning, you know, just the sort of gloss of it and not worrying over much about it. The main thing to remember for our perspective is, you know, federal law enforcement agents in the United States don't have endless official authority. You know, they don't
that
have
license to kill.
Yeah, they don't have permission to crash through and hold everybody at gunpoint and all that. That sometimes doesn't stop it from happening. But if your players try to do stuff, make sure.
I heard on the Delta Green panel, you can't do that.
You know, make sure that your players have a sense that if they're acting in an official capacity, they have other people above them watching and not wanting to get their butts chewed out for your player characters messing up and breaking the law. And if they're acting in an unofficial capacity in disguise, you know, and with all false identity so that they don't get busted in their real jobs. That's the risk, that as soon as they leave a fingerprint in the wrong place, that it might all unravel, you know. So use that to kind of keep the pressure on.
And
you can do a little bit of research to go an awful long way for that.
I'll put it this way, is that when, I'm going to assume, Dennis, that when you paint a painting with a wall in it, you don't paint every individual brick in the wall. You indicate the presence of bricks with a few strokes and let the viewer mentally assume that the rest of the bricks are there. You don't need to know.
It depends on the wall, but yes, most of the time, you are correct.
Similarly,
for the purposes of your strained analogy, sure. And this is how you do something without knowing about the topic.
We're going to let author and game designer Greg Stoltz talk about art now.
Similarly, are you done?
That's up to you.
How could you even ask that question?
I mean, the grave is still making scratching noise.
Tighten up your boots.
Stop with me, Greg.
When you're worried about the actual nuts and bolts of a government agency, what kind of details are you worried about presenting to your players? I mean, is it just merely what's my jurisdiction? You know, what's the mission of the agency, or is it what does the office look like? How bad does the air conditioning smell? Is the coffee machine new? do we get nice computers or are they shit computers? I mean, is that what kind of level do you want to penetrate?
Like, what's the challenge that you feel personally or kind of worried about?
Well, I mean, Pub Show's a chat place. Is okay. Specifically mentioned in the scenario is that at a certain point a body is found and then it becomes a homicide case. In yes. which case, local authorities take over, mm-hmm. and then they find out that Santana is a
underrated guitar guy.
Is a federal
fugitive.
Federal fugitive. So, and then jurisdiction switches over to your players as federal agents. And I had no idea that that's how that functioned. And I see that, and I think to myself, there must be tons of that. That
yeah. Oh yeah. Well, I mean, if you don't know it
and your players don't know it, you can just sail on in blithe ignorance and be happy.
Yeah.
The point I was trying to make with the brick analogy is that you could trying so hard to make Ken scratch. If you find a few representative details. A few representative details will allow them to fill in a lot of other stuff. And, you know, they won't, you know, put in the things that are interesting and they'll gloss over the things that are boring.
Yeah, I mean, the jurisdiction thing comes up a lot in Delta Green scenarios because a lot of Delta Green scenarios start off with you've been called into this FBI case, right, to do this, and because in the United States, there's sort of multiple layers of law enforcement. So almost any time the FBI is working, they're working somewhere where there are also county police and state police and local police who all might have responsibility for that part of the area. And sometimes they overlap, sometimes they don't, and it's all really, really confusing, right? So you can either spend years learning about that like we have, or you can, you know, read a couple of Wikipedia articles and just sort of fudge it. And
again, it's not like it's so clear to the people who are actually doing it for a living.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're always in jurisdictional fights with each other.
All the time.
Right?
And by the way,
the sheriff and the chief of police hate each other.
Yeah. That's right. And
one of them wants to cede the case to...
I mean, that is where I would go immediately if I didn't know what was going on. It's much more interesting to have inter-NPC conflict going on in your face where you're like, they're like, what do you think? And you're like, I think we should secure the body. They're going to jump to that.
Right.
Make it entertaining, and you won't have to make it thematically correct down to the smallest detail.
Right. There's a series of books called How Done It, which are geared towards mystery writers, and they go over stuff like ballistics and police procedure and stuff like that. So if you want to do a little more than Wikipedia, mm-hmm. but don't want to get a law degree or
those are the only two options.
Wikipedia law degree
just
in between
the aisle.
Between lies and shadow.
You're 2 and 12.
I'm doing law school.
This is gonna
flash dance.
Damn, I wish I'd invested in Wikipedia.
This is gonna be the most realistic
jurisdictional
debate you've
ever.
Right.
So
these jurisdictional confusion has gotten worse rather than better over the last 10 years, even the last 5 years. And so even reading something on jurisdictions that seems very definitive
in
2003
it doesn't.
Is about useless, in part because of the creation of parallel systems for not only counterterrorism but also natural disasters, public health. And none of those two in that triumvirate talking.
Mm-hmm. Right.
See
right.
this guy in the tent pissing out. Big hand.
Yeah. We're going in the RPG. We're going to cover a little bit of that, basically just enough to kind of give you as a GM.
Consult Wikipedia. And
a little bit of that in the players' stuff too. You know, of a couple of pages on. So you're an FBI agent.
Might be useful for the GM? We should have the lawyer stick this in. Is
oh god no
but, all right
it's just you know okay and here's how you can obscure the issue and these are the arguments you can make. Well this is my dog and pony show now because I'm the dog expert, and you know the pony expert's like, no, it's particularly dog and pony, and ponies way more.
The thing that I did in Knights Black Agents, which is a spy thriller game and had a veneer of real world material before you get to the vampires, is to remember that the game I'm writing is being written in the year 20. Well, it was written in the year 2012, but it's written in the 21st century when everyone's got freaking Wikipedia on their phone. Mm-hmm. I don't have to tell you that.
Yeah.
I have to give you just enough to get you to the right Wikipedia article.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But I don't have to describe Mossad. I just say Israel's intelligence forces, Mossad, and they're more badass than you'd think for a tiny country, and they get along really well with Britain, Germany, America. The end. And then everything else you need to know about Mossad is literally a mouse click away.
Right.
And like you pointed out, if Mossad has some sort of weird shakeup between the day I wrote the thing and the day it's published, much less the day you play it, that's not on me. You can look it up. And when I ran the thing, when I ran the alpha playtest, everything I played was basically, filtered through Wikipedia, Google Earth, the players joked that it was a three core book game. It was the playtest rules, Lonely Planet, and Wikipedia.
So we're going to this town. Let's look it up.
There it is. Here's everything you need to know.
I do exactly that for the scenarios now. It's Google Earth. It's, it's Clearwater National Forest. And, it's 19 miles up to Fable, Idaho. And, I'm not making that stuff up. I'm just finding interesting areas. Yeah. I think that's a good idea.
But you can go way down the rabbit hole in prep and know that, and there's no point to it because you can find that out in play if it comes up.
Yeah.
Instantly. And someone says, I don't think that the EPA is allowed to carry guns. And you're like, EPA fact. Look at that. There's weapons training. Shut up. Or whatever it is. Or you say, they're normally not. That's odd.
Yeah. Let's move on.
I wonder why they have a black van.
That jurisdictional stuff, you can't go wrong as a GM by just saying, it's very confused, isn't it?
This is true of everything in the federal government.
NPCs are disagreeing with each other and are at each other's throats so that it's not clear to the player characters.
Yeah, there's three different opinions among the NPCs. Which two of them do you want to piss off?
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, how is it supposed to work in theory, which is what's going to be on the government webpage, and how it actually works? If you look at all of the scandals about the FBI crime clearance stuff and their data, first of all, they're working on computers that you wouldn't expect to find in a church basement charity, much less the FBI, which on TV has magic computers that have touch screens and bring up giant fingerprints and shit. The FBI is working on an Amiga somewhere.
Yeah. No, they have like WordStar.
And it's all terrible. And so even if you're like, you wouldn't use Agar for that, it's like, they did it wrong. There you go. Welcome to apparently every single case handled by the FBI between 1987 and now.
Yeah, let me do a LexisNexis search. It's like, wait, what?
Well, you've already done 10.
What's that? What about my phone?
There's no more budget. Literally, there's a $10 trillion black budget, and we can't do a LexisNexis search?
Not your budget, no. So what else?
This is a question from the audience at home. Do you have any sort of are there any things that are sort of particularly things that you like or enjoy or feel very useful in evoking specifically contemporary horror? This is sort of intended to be the reverse of the reverse of the cell phone question, where a lot of people ask does cell phones make them less scary? As opposed to that, what is it about cell phones that is the most scary for you guys?
That when you have one, everyone, people can find you instantly by triangulating your cells, that's kind of scary.
Yeah. The presence of easy communication in a universe where learning things is dangerous, ought to imply that easy communication is dangerous.
Yeah. Hey, Dennis, that email that got sent to us? Well, Tynes read it and he shot himself in the face. Have you? You might not want to click that attachment.
Yeah.
This phone isn't getting too long. I'm putting it in this attachment.
And erase this message. Oh, and I shouldn't have called you on a cell phone.
There's a wonderful little movie that I often point towards called Pontypool.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just about a meme that breeds and kills.
Language is a virus.
And it deals with communication and technology and kind of interrelation.
There's a Japanese ghost film called Cairo.
Yeah.
Which was made into a considerably worse American film called Pulse.
Yeah.
But Cairo is exactly about the paranoia of interconnected communication and what happens when you dial a number and, you know, in the movie it's like ghosts or something is on the other end. But that's the thing about cell phones is you've got a cell phone and this now, even this terrible thing, is connected to literally, you know, anybody. You know, Boko Haram can call me. Yep. And if Boko Haram has weaponized the Pontypool meme or Greg's suicide attachment or whatever, I'm in it. I didn't choose to call Boko Haram. I didn't start that fight, but they're like, "Yeah, screw you, infidel," and boom.
Ken goes on a rampage.
Yep.
Dennis has wrote a scenario that's on the web for Delta Green called The Last Equation, which is about math and how you shouldn't study it.
Sold!
Figured that out years ago.
Mike. Yeah, mic drop. I actually heard, I don't know if the player's here, I heard the GM's here, I heard the best solution to covering up the scene I've ever heard. They just started writing other numbers. They went into the house. The house is inscribed with this horrible series of digits that drive you insane, if you know what they mean. Other agents have burned the house down. They've erased it from the wall. These guys just went around with Sharpies and started drawing in other numbers.
So that 9 becomes an 8, the 4 to a 9.
They did that all over. Then they're like, yeah, that's a good 7 hours. This should cover it. but I thought that was pretty clever and fun. Knowledge being dangerous and being transferred by, I believe, in a Google math group in The Last Equation. The guy gets it and is like, "Hey, buddies, on my Google Math Puzzles group.
Oh, that's
check this out."
Yeah, so it's up to the players to follow up with all these other math enthusiasts.
Rocco's basilisk?
Happened to get a note from this guy.
People,
So, look back at. I mean, we all love the Call of Cthulhu. You know, the Lovecraft story and his whole sort of his whole lecture about the dangers of correlating the contents of human knowledge. I mean, that's all we do these days.
Well, one of the entries for, you know, career paths is, it's your job to correlate disparate information. And then I'm like, remember what Lovecraft said about what happens when you do that?
Yeah, so plus so that job to play that up, you know, and make it clear it's easy to learn and understand things, and that's not always wonderful.
So aside from telecommunications, is there anything particularly horrible right now?
Are you awake?
I will not disagree that we live in a horrible place.
Okay.
I just want to know what you find most horrible.
I find the dissolution of human society very horrible. I mean, basically, we've gone down.
But it's new ways to shout and kill.
Yeah, I mean, we're entering great old one territory. We're the kids who are trying to hang out with the cool kids. The great old, we're smoking cigarettes behind the school and like, isn't Johnny cool? He's got a bitchin' haircut. I can be just like Nyarlathotep someday. It really feels like we're in training to do something really awful, and it seems to be spreading.
What I find kind of horrifying and appalling is the sort of ease with which people switch to abject, ruthless, and sadistic cruelty if they're under pressure, and it doesn't take a whole lot of pressure.
Which, in fairness, has got nothing to do with modernity. It just is true of people.
Yeah.
It's always happening.
In the modern day, we can learn about it and see video of it a lot.
And like it on Facebook.
Right.
But I think that really goes more to Dennis's point.
Oh, man.
Mr. Stolze, what's creeping you out these days?
What's up your modern
Missouri bug? just the militarization of the police, which is super relevant to Delta Green, it's the kind of thing that makes cynics more cynical. It's like, I'm so cynical, I'm tired of cynicism now. Cynicism's over, but what else is there?
I'm always creeped out by mental illness, only because there's no defense against it. You know, it's this internal thing that attacks you from inside you. The problem's in you. You don't get a. There's no. I mean, we have a lot of stuff in Call of Cthulhu where you're losing sand points because you chose to get involved with this bullshit, you know, and are pursuing an agenda and you're trying
Clicks
to save
the attachment.
Yeah. But actual mental illness is there. You don't buy into it. You don't have a choice. It just shows up and it just ruins your life. And it destroys your ability to interact with your loved ones or recognize them as loved ones or, you know, and that actually deeply creeps me out. That
and
the,
they don't know how to fix it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and in the United States, we do very, very little, even with what we do know about it.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, my wife is a cop. She was had a traffic stop today and got attacked by a crazy schizophrenic woman. Yeah. You know, out of nowhere. And I mean, she's fine. You know, everybody's okay. But
you got that phone call today. That's not good.
Yeah, and
the woman identified herself as Charles Manson.
Right.
As well.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's crazy and an original.
Freaking creepy.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the mental illness is one that always really, really disturbs me, the idea. Because, you know, the idea that you could lose control of your body, I've known people who've dealt with things like, you know, cancer or injuries that have lost them the control of their body. Mm-hmm. But there was always this sort of thing where, you know, most people, you know, those situations, those people sort of, you know, sort of dealt with that situation by having control of their mind and having some sort of discipline. But the idea that you can't get a grip on your mind, that you cannot control your perceptions or your the conclusions you draw from those perceptions, that really is disturbing.
Well, what we can do with that in the game and in the fiction is to find some, you know, I don't know, pursue some catharsis about that by sort of taking it to its extremes and turning it into
wouldn't
more
it be lovely
visceral
if this horror. If the schizophrenia came from somewhere else,
something I could kill.
Yeah.
Sorcerer Gumbo.
It all leads to Sorcerer Gumbo.
if you're doing it right.
Yeah.
It's a good band name.
That is the Delta Green cover band name.
It
will be Sorcerer Gumbo.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we're like 20 minutes past when we were going to wrap
all
this
right.
up.
Yes.
So,
does anybody have more tickets?
Any more tickets?
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks
for coming.
Yes.
Thank you.
I don't know if we'll be able to do this question. Yeah.